Well, I think the original top topic that was advertised has now changed. So after just an informal survey of the various participants, I learned that maybe people might be more interested in the grid cell talk. But those of you who are interested in learning about stereotypy in the fly brain, I'd be very happy to talk about it. So maybe we can chat in the afternoon. So, but right now, I won't discuss that issue. So this is one example of the now famous grid cells. And I think most of you, or all of you, have probably heard about them. But for the few of you who might not, let me just summarize. So this is a plot of the activity of a single neuron called now a grid cell. It resides in the entorhinal and the dorsolateral band of the entorhinal cortex of rats, in the rat brain. And entorhinal cortex, as many of you know, is sort of the gateway for all of the cortical information into the hippocampus. And hippocampus is famous for place cells, which encode where the rat is in small enclosures. So it was the question was how much of the place-specific activity of hippocampal cells can be found in grid cells. And this is a recording from the group of the Moser's group. The paper came out in the end of 2005. So this is a cell from layer 2-3 of cortex. And what you're seeing here is the red dot represents a single spike of one neuron. All right, and it's plotted as a function of x, y space where the rat, the instantaneous location of the rat when that spike was emitted. And the black line that you see is the trajectory of the rat as the rat is running through this enclosure, randomly foraging for food pellets that are scattered. Yeah. Right, so as you can see, this is a pretty remarkable correlation. The firing is remarkably regularly correlated with position, and in fact, it looks like the blobs are arranged on some kind of a regular triangular lattice, an array. So this is indeed a very striking experimental result. And since most of you know about it, I'm not going to belabor all the properties except to mention a few, summarize a few of the most salient properties of these cells. So
what area of cortex is this on?
This is layer 2-3. That recording was layer 2-3 of the dorsolateral band of the medial entorhinal cortex. So a very narrow strip within that region. So the most salient properties for the purposes of what I'm going to talk about are the following. So this is a single cell recorded in enclosures of two different sizes, and the periodicity of the response does not scale with the size of the external enclosure. So it's not a function of the external enclosure. If you record two neurons in the same electrode, which is neighboring neurons that are sitting very close to each other, then the different cells are coded in the different colors, and you can see that their periodicity is the same, and so is the orientation of the lattice. The only thing that differs is the phase, which, in other words, translations in X and Y. And so that's just illustrated here. The centers of these blobs can be overlaid on each other by just simple shifts in X and Y. All right, and finally, the last major observation I'm going to make for this talk is just summarizing the fact that although nearby neurons have exactly the same period, if you travel, this is to answer your question, this is a picture of one of the slices through the entorhinal cortex, and this is this dorsolateral band. It goes from dorsal to ventral. The recordings have been done from the dorsal boundary to about midway through the dorsal boundary. And as you go systematically through this area, the period of the response actually systematically changes. In fact, the periodicity increases of the lattice. Right. So in the measured half of the band, the periods go from about 30 centimeters to 70 centimeters. And because the relationship is monotonic, you could imagine extrapolating to the remaining half, the unmeasured half of the layer. And if you do a linear or an exponential fit to this, maybe you get some kind of limit of about 2 to maybe less than 10 meters of the maximum periodicity of the response.
How did they find those cells?
There was no technological advance that led to the finding of these cells. It was partly experimental serendipity. It was the desire to record. So because it's the gateway to hippocampus, the Mosers had been pursuing all the inputs to hippocampus, so they happened to be measuring there. The other critical thing that made it possible was that they recorded in a larger enclosure than conventional. So most of these recordings in enclosures are 1 meter diameter. And when they recorded in 1 meter, they happened to notice that sometimes there were more than one response blobs. And then they expanded their enclosure to 2 meters when the pattern became apparent. So I think it's also tucked away a little bit. So I think it's just the desire to target that area plus the slightly larger enclosures that made it possible to find these cells. So yeah, not a breakthrough in some new experimental technique. All right, so that means, okay, so this is bizarre, all right? So the one thing I should contrast in the previous thing is that, so maybe the maximum lattice period is about 2 or 10 meters, but I should point out that that's a lot smaller than the recorded range of these Norway rats. These rats in the wild seem to forage over distances of 100 meters to 1 kilometer per linear dimension. So it's very different than the scale of their natural behavior. So these observations bring up many, many questions. And the two questions that popped into my mind in the following order were just, why? Why would two coordinate rat position be decomposed in this bizarre way into many periodic variables, into these very 2D sort of dense arrangements of neural activity? And also what? So what's contained in the code? So position determines firing, but the question is, from firing, can you completely extract position again? Is it a fully invertible representation, and over what range? All right, and the next question is how, mechanistically, how are these responses generated in a plausible neural network scenario? So what kind of connectivity would you have to assume to be able to reproduce those responses? So I'm going to talk about first the why question, and I hope I can also advance to the how question. So let's start with the why question. And so the observation, so now just to sort of state in simple mathematical terms what the observation is, it's this, right? So there's a rat in an enclosure. It's sitting here. And it basically is some cell that's active that has a response at that phase in this unit cell. So basically, the blue cell, if it fires, all you know is where is the rat relative to only up to all possible shifts by all integer multiples of the lattice period along the primary directions. So it's a very non-specific code for where the rat is, any single cell. And in fact, the whole population of cells that share the same period at most just give you phase or position within a unit cell of the lattice. So it's not very informative. And so let's just look at the one-dimensional analog. In the one-dimensional analog, you just have a cell that fires at, say, the middle of the period, and it fires again in the middle of the period, and so on. So the coding is a many, many positions mapped to a single phase. So it's a many-to-one mapping of position to phase. And in 1D, we can even just make this very simple observation that the response, the code of for rat position is just you take rat position, do integer division by the lattice period, and just the modular remainder is x hat, or the phase. So that's all you're getting out of one period, is just the modulo remainder. So that's a very simple observation, but it turns out there are a lot of implications that flow from that observation. So first of all, that was only one period, so of course there's a set of grid periods, you know, n of them, lambda. And so what you get is, let's only talk about 1D from now on, just because it's easy to discuss. You get actually a set of phases, not just one phase. You get a set of phases, which is the same position x of the rat modular all the different lattice periods. So that's the response. So
before you go on, you've got this lattice with different resolutions. Does that mean that if the rat is in a particular position, that there's an activity at each at different levels of resolution?
That's right. So when the rat is at one location x, in every lattice, there's some neuron that's active.
Okay.
And and which neuron is active is just, if you label neurons by their phase, by their preferred x hat, then it's that x hat neuron, you know, I'm labeling neurons by their phase, so each neuron has a preferred x hat, and it fires whenever x is such that x mod lambda is x hat.
So it's like a positional gradient with coarse, medium, and fine settings, for example.
Right. It's like taking a position and dividing it by, it's like taking the number 21 and saying 21 modulo 3 is 0, so the remainder is 0, right? So I write down a number 0. And then you take the number 4, say you want to say 24 modulo 4, and you say the remainder is 1, so you write down the number 1. And then say the next period is 5. You say 21 modulo 5 is 1, so you write down 1. That's right, so it's just remainders relative to these different periods.
Thank you.
Is the firing of these neurons basic in the sense that as the mouse enters the position where a particular neuron corresponds to a point in space, that the firing ramps up? Is there temporal information about how the
Right. So I think your question is coming from, for example, the hippocampal field, where they find that place cells have this phase precession. There's a theta oscillation. So as the rat enters its the receptive field of a cell, the probability of firing it fires at earlier and earlier parts of the theta cycle as it enters. Yes, actually, so that's a very recent result, and it looks like there is that same kind of phase precession in the cells of the entorhinal cortex.
These phases aren't sharp. The mouse is actually getting some phase information over range as it approaches.
Right. So what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to ignore all the fine temporal information, other than to say that it fires at this location with some wide envelope. There may be extra information contained within the actual spike timings. So since we're talking about, you know, what's conveyed in the code, a code has many properties that, you know, you can ask, why is a code the way it is based on many considerations, and what is the capacity of the code, how readable is the code, you know, how do downstream areas interpret the code, and so on. So let's first concentrate on capacity. So let's consider a really idealized cartoon case, which is not at all the real case, but just for the purpose of this one slide, let's discuss it. So the idealization is, for the moment, consider that X, the rat position, and the period, the whole numbers, and dimensionless, right? So they're just integers and dimensionless. In that case, the Chinese remainder theorem guarantees that the representation of X broken into all its moduli is unique and invertible over this very large range X max, which is given by just the least common multiple of all the lattice periods. So if your lattice periods are 3, 4, and 5, then the range is just the product of all the moduli.
So I'm just worrying about something.
Yeah.
That is that you seem to be saying that the cell only fires or doesn't fire. But actually, it fires in a graded way depending on position. Isn't there extra information in that?
So there may, I mean, in a sense, you might say there's less information because it's like smearing out. There's some uncertainty in where it's firing. So if the cell fires, you don't know whether it's at the peak of its response or.
You have a lot of cells.
That's right. That's right.
So basically, it's kind of a cosine wave, and for any one cell, you have information about not just about the.
That's right.
The phase, and you're going that way.
No. So actually, so right now, I'm just considering a very idealized case. In the next slide, I'm going to actually introduce some uncertainty. And that's going to play exactly into how well you can resolve the phase even within a unit cell. So just if you just hold on for one slide.
Sure.
All right? So in the idealized case, the maximum range that you can represent is the product of all the lambdas, if the lambdas are actually co-primed to each other. And if they are co-primed to each other, then the scaling is like lambda to the n, where there are n different lattices. All right, so this is a specific example of the moduli are 13, 15, 16, 17, and 19. Then you can represent the number 20, you can represent the number 1 million, and in fact, you can represent numbers bigger than 1 million. This is the full range of the representation. But clearly, grid cells are not, you know, I mean, rat position is actually dimension full quantity. It's a real number, and if you take a product of centimeters, you get centimeter to the n, which doesn't make any sense. So how do we actually define capacity in the case of these grid cells? So X and periods are dimensional and they're real numbers. The phases are not modular residues. They're actually real phases. So we can take X mod lambda divided by lambda, multiply by 2 pi, for example. So that's really the phase of the cell. And then in addition, as Chuck is pointing out, there's a associated phase uncertainty, which may be fine or coarse, depending on what your assumptions are about how well you can read out the phase, given the whole population response. So there's just some phase uncertainty, which we're going to call delta phi.
But that's sort of like saying if you do a Fourier expansion, that there's a phase uncertainty.
No. That's not what I mean. What I mean is just that. If you have the whole population response, I told you. So in the idealized case, there's no uncertainty, right? As long as you just read out the phase, you just read out the modular remainder, and that's exactly it's X mod lambda. You know exactly. But what I'm saying now is, you look at the whole population response, and you don't know. So in this figure. In this figure, for example, this is the whole population response. It's just the rat happens to be at a position where the blue cell's active, but the green and the red cells aren't active. All right? But if the blue cell's active, you have no idea where the rat is. It, up to some delta phi, it may not be as big as the blob, because as you say, it's a population code. If it's only a single neuron, you would say the uncertainty delta phi was as big as the blue blob. With the population, it may be smaller, and I'm not specifying where the delta phi is. All I'm saying is, you know the whole population response, so you know this the rat's somewhere in this location, and you don't know exactly where it is up to some delta phi. That's just the.
I was just thinking, if you had it on a one-dimensional space like that,
yeah.
and if you have firing of cells depending on the different rate at every single position on there,
mm-hmm.
and so it seems like as long as you could resolve that you have more information than just where the peak is.
Oh, right. I'm saying that. So it's not rate. So first of all, it's a spiking code, right? So we're looking instantaneously at whether a cell spiked or didn't.
I see.
So we're not doing rates. And perhaps. So all I'm saying is maybe you have more information. But again, that's not excluded, right? Because all I'm saying is there's some delta phi. I'm not telling you how fine or coarse it is, right?
Okay.
You'll admit there's some error. I mean, you can't know perfectly. Even no matter what you do, as long as there's some finite resolution with or some stochasticity associated with neural response or some finite resolution with which you can read out the response, there's going to be some error. So it's just a general statement, right? It's just a coarse grained statement that there's some error delta phi. So, and then we discuss more otherwise. So in this case, what's capacity? So the crude capacity estimate you can make is the following. So you can say the number of states per lattice is like 1 over delta phi, like just if you discretize it in a very crude way. This is a very crude estimate. And they're n lattices, so it's to the nth power. And then the transition, the distance you have to travel before you transition from one state to the next is you have to move by lambda times delta phi to move from one discretized set of phases to the next. So this is just a very crude estimate, and we're going to do numerically more exact calculation to see how similar the actual case capacity is compared to this crude estimate.
What is n in capital N?
N is the number of lattices.
What's the dimensionality of the capacity?
I'm sorry? This is all 1D. I'm only talking 1D. So this is per linear dimension.
Length?
It's length. That's right. So lambda is a length. Lambda is a length. Phase is dimensionless. Delta phi is dimensionless, and so it's just length.
So capacity is how big an area the animal can.
How long a range the animal can uniquely represent. Okay. That's right, with this code. All right, and so really this is very crude because I'm discretizing. I'm putting phases into boxes, and that doesn't really make sense. So really, the numerical calculation, the question you want to ask is how far can the animal travel before landing within a box of psi delta phi of a previously encountered set of phases. And now this box is multidimensional. It's n-dimensional box. It's delta phi on a side. All right. So as soon as you wrap around and so you get into within delta phi of a previous phase, then you know that you're done. You repeat again because it's a periodic code. So in the realistic case, so we can just compute that numerically. So we can run the rat using some set of lattices. So here, everything you see is going to be a set of 12 lattices that start at 30 centimeters and then grow every 4 centimeters spacing across lattices. And what you find is that the distance, the maximum, the capacity of the rat scales like 1 over delta phi to n effective minus 1. So this is roughly the scaling we expected from the very crude argument with some caveats. So so the bottom line is that scaling is like a power in the number of states, or 1 over the phase resolution to the nth power. But n is now some renormalized thing. It's not as big as the real n. N effective is 10.5, whereas the real n we used was 12. So it's some kind of it's slightly reduced capacity compared to some kind of idealized crude estimate that you would expect. But it still scales roughly like how you would want. Now, how does it scale with n? So this is the scaling with the phase resolution, and this is the scaling with the number of lattices. So as you vary the number of lattices, actually the scaling, instead of looking like 1 over delta phi to n minus 1, it's actually renormalized again by some constant alpha. And that alpha actually is about 0.9. So it's not quite 1. It's less than 1. So these are the penalties that you pay for having these uncertainties in the phase and for having these real valued things that are not co-prime in any sense. There's no notion of co-primeness.
You know, intuitively, I would think that having increase the capacity, right? Because you can actually really measure whether you are
Well, there's a delta phi, there's a phase resolution, right? It's finite. So I don't know. I mean, right? The crude argument I made was like you discretize it by units of the phase resolution, and then the scaling is just by analogy with the idealized case. And I'm just saying that the numerical calculation looks like it's something similar. So I don't know what you'd expect. You would just expect, I think, something very similar to the idealized case because of the finite phase resolution. It's true that if you had infinite phase resolution, meaning there was no phase error, then you just need two lattices, and as long as they're irrational, the ratio is irrational, you're done. You're set for life. You know, you have infinite. You can represent the whole scale of the universe. So that's right. So even though the representation appears to be bizarre and wasteful within a lattice, the population of population codes across lattices is actually truly combinatorial in the number of lattices. So that's pretty interesting.
What about the lattice size?
No. In this calculation, so I should point out that in this calculation I used 12 lattices in both cases, and the lattice periods were from 30 centimeters up to 74 centimeters, spaced in 30, 34, 38. So with spacing. Oh yeah, it tiles the whole plane. That's right. We assume that the lattice is tiling the whole plane. And I guess I should explain that that assumption arose from the observation that the response is independent of the size of the enclosure and the shape of the enclosure within the range of enclosures they've tested. So the assumption is that the response with the cells tiles the whole plane. That's right. So why is capacity important? I mean, why is it such a big deal that capacity be combinatorially large? I mean, that's pretty huge. So there are a couple of reasons to the rat why it's important to have some representation in its brain, which is a large range and, on the other hand, a high-resolution representation of position. So the rat's range, as I pointed out already before, is pretty large. I mean, a conservative estimate is 100 meter by 100 meter, but often as big as 1 kilometer per side. So the rat wants to assign unique name labels to various landmarks and locations in its range. It needs a representation that spans a wide range. On the other hand, the rat also needs a very high resolution code for position. We know that because behaviorally the rat is capable of accurate idiothetic, meaning its internally computed sense of where it is, even in the absence of external landmarks and sensory input. So this is an experiment where the rat sets out and it's in the dark and it can't see stuff, and it sets out randomly foraging for food, comes here, finds a food pellet, and then it just makes a beeline back to its nest. So it's actually summed all these little vector displacements and realized that the vector towards home is just like that. So to avoid all the accumulating rounding errors that would accrue if the representation for position internally were coarse, it would need a very fine representation of position to be able to do that kind of calculation.
Just a side comment. From an evolutionary point of view, it's extremely unlikely rats grow up in spatially uniform, flat environments where this kind of orientation would be needed. I mean, I assume they have olfactory maps of their environment and...
It's true. It's very true. So there's the question of why a rat would need that, and they do often go out in the dark where there are not so many visual cues. But as you point out, since like olfactory cues are very important for rats, and these experiments are very challenging because it's hard to remove all olfactory cues from the experiments. But controlled experiments show where cues actually are removed. In fact, that experiment, the cues were removed because what they did is they actually rotate. So when there's an internal table where the rat finds the food, they rotate the external table. So what the rat thought was home, the rat still thinks home is this way, but they actually rotate the hole. So any physical cues have rotated, but the rat still goes along the real direction. So the phenomenological explanation, the observation, is that they can path integrate. Why, I don't know. I mean, it's a very good question. I guess somehow...
The entorhinal cortex does get sensory input from more than one. They get vision, auditory...
That's right.
...information. And so this, to a rat, position is probably an integrated activity. And even though visual cues might overwhelm the informational content in your experiment, in a real-life setting, I wouldn't expect that to be true.
There's no evidence for this in humans, right? I get lost all the time.
I think they have done path integration. They put people out on an L maze. So you go through a corridor that's L-shaped, and then you have to just return in the free space along the diagonal, of course, back to your home base. And, I mean, they're different species have different abilities. For example, dogs are very, very good. But humans can do it. Not as well as dogs, but it's a quantitative, not a qualitative difference. All right, so let's before moving away from capacity, let me just make one more observation just a sort of comparison between entorhinal cortex and hippocampus, which is until now being thought of as the until the discovery of these grid cells was thought of as the sort of the seat of position-based representations in the brain, that the place that represents the rat's location. So if you just compare capacities with these 12 lattices that I told you about in the previous slide, with the 5 × 10^4 grid cells, and this is assuming very high redundancy of grid cells. I'm assuming 5,000 neurons are necessary to code just 30 centimeters squared. 30 centimeters per linear dimension with 6 centimeter resolution, right? So within a lattice, I'm assuming a very large number of neurons are necessary to specify, you know, positions up to 30 centimeters long with good phase accuracy. And even then, all we need is 5 × 10^4 cells to represent a linear distance of, you know, 2 kilometers. All right, but by comparison, for the same kind of a dynamic range, you would need 10^10 idealized place cells with unimodal fields to do the same sort of dynamic range of representation. And things, if you even just scale up from 12 lattices to 24, suddenly the represented range of positions grows, you know, dramatically to 2 × 10^8 meters. And this is, of course, very, very large, and you would need something like 10^20 place cells. But the rat brain contains only 10^6 place cells, and these cells with the same resolution can only represent a position uniformly with high resolution in a 20 meter per side enclosure, very small compared to the rat range. So the conclusions we can draw from this is just that uniform coverage of large spaces by hippocampal place cells is basically impossible, and it implies the hippocampus is not the path integrator or the locus of general purpose information in the brain. So beyond capacity, yeah.
This was experimental, this hippocampal place cell.
This count of number of place cells, 10^6, was by Amaral.
No,
so it's an experimental.
My concern.
No, this is just the statement based on just number of neurons. You just take the number of cells.
Experimentally, how? I mean, if you put a rat in a large.
That's right. The prediction would be if you put a rat in a 20-meter enclosure. So in 1-meter enclosures, they find that they're placed cells.
I'm asking, is there any data?
There's no data on large enclosures, and I wish there were. This is one of the predictions, that they will not find uniform assignment of placed cells that cover all of that space. In contrast to what they find in small enclosures, where they do find, you know, a basically uniform coverage of space.
But isn't it true that in whatever enclosure you put rats in, you find place cells?
Yes, but they're all small enclosures. That's the key. So it's not pushing the representational.
It's not obvious that they wouldn't be able to rescale to a larger.
Yes, but then the resolution may not be the same. But then, of course, that's right. The statement is just that with the fixed resolution, it's not possible to represent the bigger.
So you would have representations in different contexts.
That's right.
If the animal is navigating in a large area and then it goes into some smaller area,
it might then refine the place.
It uses a different set of place cells for this new.
That's exactly
place
right.
That
that's exactly right. So it would be a very different picture, sort of place cell assignment than we have from looking at place cell assignment in small enclosures.
It would
be non-uniform impact.
But I thought the scale of the place cell was changing as you change along the hippocampus.
Well, there's the place cells form a zoo of varieties, and there are place cells whose fields expand exactly in proportion with the size of the enclosure. There are other place, and the location also shifts accordingly. So you just do the map, you just stretch everything, you cement the place cell on there, the response, and you stretch everything together. There are place cells whose response does not change as you increase the enclosure size. There are cells whose location, the distance from the wall stays fixed, not the location relative to all the parameters in the space. It's a zoo. So, yeah, so that's the evidence we have so far about the. Okay, so yeah.
So this place cell prediction has nothing to do with grid cells, right? That's like purely in the logic of place.
It's just in the. That's right. It's just the logic. I mean, it just motivated us. I mean, when we realized that this representation has such high resolution, the question is, can place cells possibly be doing it? And I mean, maybe this is just some epiphenomenon. So the question is, to eliminate the possibility that that place cells are doing the job that, you know, entorhinal cells seem poised to do. So,
am I missing something? You don't need place cells once you have these lattice cells?
No, that's not true at all, actually. So I don't think I'm going to get to the point of readouts and things like that, but it turns out that the many things that you do need place cells for. For example, if you want sparse representations of your location so that you want to anchor things to other cues, sensory cues, to your location label, you can think of place cells as sparse location labels that are already assigned by grid cells. So these grid cells have unique states, right, for a large range of locations. Now you might tag a specific location as something special you want to remember and associate it with other visual cues, in which case a place cell can pool from the set of coactive grid cells across lattices and serve as that sparse label. And sparse labels are important for a number of computations. So it's possible that that's what place cells are for. But that's kind of speculative. So. So what are the other properties that follow from this modular representation? So some of the other observations we can make are to compare this kind of representation where you break up one variable, a scalar variable, into a set of periodic registers. Another natural scheme for doing that is fixed-base number systems, right? So like decimal, binary, all these number systems are basically taking a number and breaking it into a set of periodic variables of different scales. So one thing, though, in all these fixed-base numeral systems is to represent a number like a million. What you need is, if it's 10 to the 6, you need a range of these registers that the span that spans the size from 10 to the 0 up to 10 to the 6. So it's a very large range of the underlying parameters that you need scaled. By contrast, the modulo system, you can use periods that are basically the same size, and you can get similar ranges, but without requiring a very large dynamic range in the parameter, the underlying parameter. So another consequence of the observation that the periods may all be the same size, in contrast to fixed-base number systems, is that information about position at all scales is shared equitably across all the periods. So unlike the decimal system where, for example, if I wanted to represent the number 800,000 versus 800,001, here the only thing that increments in decimal is the smallest digit. But in residue number systems, everything, all the registers, all the modulo phases have incremented. And that's also true when you go from 45 to 800,000, again, they've all incremented. So there's no segregation of information to just a small set of the underlying registers. So information at all scales is shared in all the lattices equitably. So what does that mean for biology? This seems kind of abstract. So the statement in biology is that you do not require network parameters, like the underlying parameters, to span several orders of magnitude in the underlying.
Isn't there also an advantage to this modular system that you do not need the origin of the coordinate system? So that you can form this representation without exploring sizable coordinate space?
Yes, but isn't that also true for decimal? I mean, you just count up, you just take your starting value as whatever it is, and you just count up from there.
But
is that?
What if you have to go back?
You just go negative, I guess? Okay, that's true. So that's right. That's right. That's an interesting point, yeah. So, all right. So then another, okay. So one more thing in the previous case is also another implication that flows from this equitable sharing of information is that lesions of any lattice should have equally profound effects on the behavior of the rat. There should be no hierarchy in the behavioral response based on which lattices are really lesions. So the second non-capacity kind of property of the modular representation that makes it pretty useful in this context of updating position estimates is the fact that arithmetic in modulo system is carry-free. So normally when we sum, we have to carry numbers to the next register. In modulo code, we just take 97 and write it as modulo 7, 6, 5, and we get this number and this number. And when you sum 2 plus 4 is 6, modulo 5 is 1, and you don't actually carry over a digit to the next register. It's very nice. All right, and this is the correct number. You can verify that 101 equals 351 modulo 765. So you don't have to carry information across lattices. So so that's pretty nice because it means that these subnetworks can be actually discrete without passing information across. All right, and the last property, which may or may not be something that's advantageous, is just the fact that metrics in the space of the modulo phases is unrelated to real space metrics. So, for example, if I were just to plot, you know, delta x here, the displacement of the rat, versus the correlation in the phase representation, the phase representation for the position x and the phase representation for position x plus delta x, and compute the correlation of those, you can see that there's a region where the correlation is monotonically decreasing with position, which is okay because that means it's monotonically related to displacement. But then the relationship becomes non-monotonic. right? Which means that basically it's not easy to make distance comparisons beyond the scale of just the size of the individual lattices. And by not easy, I mean that it's not possible for a single layer network to do that kind of computation. So the downstream uses of the grid cell code, I think I'm going to skip, except just to mention that you can envision, like Henry asked the questions of what are place cells good for. You can envision a couple of different sort of complementary, not mutually exclusive ways in which you could use this information. So it's not possible. To invert the grid cell code is actually very complicated. So to go from the phases back to positions or distances or metric labels is actually a very difficult task. You need, in the case of idealized integer periods, there's actually an explicit formula. In the absence of integer coprime periods, there's no explicit formula, and actually the task is complicated. So, but nevertheless, if you want to do things like do homing and compute distance vectors back to home after random excursions, it would be impossible to, it would be important to have some mechanism to do explicit metric readouts. The other possibility is the grid cells are never then, the representation is never used to recompose the position X. All right, and then you might ask, well, what's the use of such a readout if it doesn't actually recompose the position X in terms of the metrics of real space? And the statement is then that there's still actually a lot of uses for these kinds of labels, and it could be that place cells are those kinds of labels. Sarah, should I? Can I spend five more minutes? Yeah, so I'm just going to skip some of these uses, actually, so we can talk about those uses, but I just want to quickly get to just two or three slides on just the dynamics, just to give you a flavor of the dynamics, and that's the shorter part, so I just want to conclude this part just by saying that it's pretty remarkable that the brain has devised a way to represent just a continuous metric variable by this kind of number system, which is arithmetic friendly, positional, and amenable to arithmetic operations like addition and vector summation and things like that. I think that's a pretty amazing thing, and it's on a population-to-population level. So each lattice is a population, and the lattices interact with one another in this way to, in concert, give this very high-range representation of space. So this was a motivational slide for why we care about the mechanistic picture. So you might say, by extension of the capacity argument, you might say that the total number of neurons in the whole grid cell network summed across all lattices scales like the number of lattices times the phase resolution per lattice. But the capacity is actually depends very differentially on this is the total number is just a product, but it scales like exponentially with n, but only like a power. So you might, the logical thing to say is, for optimality, you might want to drive the phase resolution to be very low and increase at the cost, you know, and increase the number of lattices. So why do you have a certain phase resolution? Why devote a certain number of neurons to the representation within a lattice? And that motivates sort of the question of how.
What's the experimental estimate of n?
There is none. I could make an estimate. So DMAC, the entorhinal cortex as a whole, contains about 10 to the 5 neurons. And from the modeling of the dynamics of the network, we require about 10 to the 4 neurons per network. So I would say order 10. So.
So I missed the bottom line of the previous.
Yes.
So the
trade-off, so the point is, for high capacity, you want to drive delta phi large. You want to drive this to zero, and you want to drive that to large while keeping the total number fixed, right? If you have a fixed total number, you want to increase that and decrease that.
Okay.
Right, because capacity grows so much faster with n than with 1 over delta phi.
Okay, but then there would be only one neuron in each lattice?
Or just some low number, right? And you want to drive it as low as possible. And the question is, why stop where it is? Why not go lower than that? Right, because it's at some finite value. So, right. So now we go to how, and I'm not going to give you many, many details. I'm just going to sort of summarize some of the main elements that go into reproducing the dynamics of the grid cell network. So part one is a static pattern formation process. So imagine a cortical sheet. This is a sheet of cortex. And imagine that each neuron has center-surround connectivity with its neighbors. If the lateral flanks are inhibitory enough, then they, a group of neurons here, if it's active, will inhibit all its neighbors. And a neuron can only come on once it's beyond that range. And so on, and a neuron, another neuron can come on beyond that range and so on. So the just Turing instability leads to generically pattern formation in the shape of a triangular lattice when the flanks, inhibitory flanks, are large enough. This is very generic with centers around connections. So that's part one. Part two, I'll just summarize here, is it's not sufficient to have static pattern formation because if you're recording from a single neuron, there's no coupling through rat motion, and all you would see is a neuron that's either active all the time or inactive all the time. So the second thing you need to do is couple the pattern with rat velocity input in a way to make the pattern flow. So the ansatz is, if the pattern were to flow in linear proportion to the rat motions in the real plane, then if you were recording from a single neuron and the rat is moving rightward, you would see this neuron come stay on, and then the pattern would flow off, so it would go off, and then this blob would come into that view, it would turn on again, and you'd reproduce the periodicity of the population lattice with the period that's the product of the population period times the velocity gain. So that's the ansatz, and I'm going to end with this slide, which is just to tell you an idea for how to realize that kind of velocity response. So imagine that each cell in each local patch here has a label now, and the label is theta. It tells the neuron has a special direction selectivity, and that means two things. The first thing that means is that the neuron labeled with a certain theta, the blue neuron, receives input from velocity cells that are tuned to rat motion in a certain direction, in that direction. So blue cells fire when the rat moves in the northward direction. So the cells are labeled by the velocity inputs they receive. And secondly, the color coding also means the following. The theta label means that the outgoing connections of every neuron are shifted just by epsilon in the direction in which they also receive velocity input, right? So they're slightly shifted. So the blue cell slightly shifted upward, the yellow cell downward, and so on. So if the input to all the neurons were balanced, no equal velocity input everywhere, then this forms a push-pull circuit, and the activity pattern, that pattern stays static. But if the blue neuron receives biased input because the rat's moving in that direction, its activity wins over all the other activities, and it succeeds in driving translational movement. And then there are a lot of subtleties that actually go into making this possibility a reality, but I'm going to discuss that in person because we're kind of running short on time. So I'll stop here.
There are ants that are known from experiments to be able to wander over large ranges.
That's right, Cataglyphus porti.
Once they discover food, it's unlikely, I would guess, they have grid cells.
And
they do it presumably by very high accuracy space integrators, where they just integrate their vector. Is it possible that the rat could be doing that also? And
well, again, so to do high accuracy, this is just a mechanism through which you can do high accuracy path integration, right? You need a position representation, you need an increment mechanism that updates your representation of where you are. So even the ant, to be able to do high resolution path integration in 2D, has to have a representation that's fine-grained, like very fast.
Like strokes. Hmm? I assume it counts leg strokes.
Well, it doesn't just count leg strokes, because there's a recent experiment. So the ants that Henry's talking about is Cataglyphus fortis. These are ants that live in the desert, and they wander in featureless spaces, and they manage to go out distances of up to 200 meters foraging and make a beeline path back. Well, the number of neurons in the brain is too small.
They could, but they have about a million neurons altogether in the brain.
So it's quite mysterious. In fact, this is the question that, so people have not succeeded in doing physiology on these Cataglyphus ants. And I'm talking to a postdoc from Minner's group who is in Caltech right now, and he's quite interested in doing some physiology in desert ants. But it's kind of like poking the dog because nobody's well characterized the brain of these ants. And it's a great question. I mean, I'm dying to know what the answer is because, as I couldn't tell you in the dynamic story, it turns out that the number of neurons is already a severe restriction in the accuracy with which path integration can happen, even in this network where we're assuming 10 to the 5 cells.
No, I'm just remembering that, that for the particular grid spacing, you have cells that are displaced from the edge by all different amounts along the two axes. Isn't that right?
So,
So, so right here, this is one cell.
That's right.
But there'd be another cell, and it would have the same grid, except that its grid point would be in between.
That's exactly right.
So you have a lot more information than you were talking about.
No, that's right. No, the whole population. No. So I agree. There's a whole population, and they have all different faces. All the same period, all the same orientation. The only thing that differs is their face. That's exactly right. So in fact, in this network, that will be the case, because this neuron is actually going to where the rat is, say, here. There's another neuron, there's another neuron, because it's a whole cortical sheath, it's a dense sheath.
Yeah, so the neuron with the same grid spacing.
That's right, it will have exactly, so the neighboring neuron, the neuron sitting here, is going to have exactly the same period as this neuron here.
Yeah.
It's going to also have the same orientation, because you see, all that's allowed is translations of this pattern. All right? So this neuron is going to have the same period, it's going to have the same orientation. It's just going to differ by shift, and the shift corresponds to how much the rat needs to move this pattern from here to there. It's only going to be spatially shifted. So that's exactly right. You will have all phases. And for the previous story, too, I assumed that all the phases were present.
But you have all phases, and you have all spaces.
And you have all spacing.
So you have a lot of information. You map a two-dimensional space into a higher dimension.
Well, you have exactly what I assumed in the previous story, right? Which is that within a period, you have all the phases, right? All the remainder. So if you only had one cell, you would know, for example, so suppose, let's take a simple example. You want to represent the number 21, and let's look in the lattice of period 5, right? You should have one cell that represents, you just have a lattice of period 5. So the first cell is going to be active whenever x modulo 5 is 1. The second cell is going to be active whenever x modulo 5 equals 2. The third cell will be active whenever x modulo 5 equals 3. You have all those cells. They're just shifts. They represent phase shifts by each other. And that's how you can tell the position within a unit cell. So
to answer your question, so imagine a unit cell like this. If you only had one cell, you would only know, is the rat here or not? If you have many cells, then you can say, is the rat here, or is it here, or is it here? So I am assuming that you have information of exactly where the rat is within the unit cell. I'm saying you know whether it's here, here, or here. You don't just know whether the rat is here or not,
which would be the case if you only had one phase within each lattice. I am assuming that you had exact information up to delta phi of where the rat is within the unit cell. So I do assume that. It's a good observation. So.
But this model assumes that in the entorhinal cortex, things that are coding for different positions are just well placed, and there is some translational invariance, which is not at all what is seen in the experiment. I mean, I thought that there was absolutely no order in the cell, that if you record the neighboring cell, do not...
That's a great question. So exactly. So the point Vincent is making is that in the experimental system, when you pick up cells from a single electrode, they actually, in this picture, if you were to record nearby cells, they would all have about the same phase, meaning they would tend to be coactive. All right? So that's, and in an experimental situation, it turns out when you're recording from a single electrode, you actually find cells with a diverse set of phases, all possible phases, which suggests that the arrangement of these cells relative to this connectivity is not topographic. Right? So for the purposes of the model, what you can do is you can lay out a topographic arrangement with respect to the weights, set the weights, and then scramble all the cells pairwise, the positions, while keeping the weights fixed. But it raises a very interesting question of how do you form this network in the first place? And there's some ideas. We don't really know the answer, but it's a great question. I mean, we just don't know how. It's a real mystery. So, yeah.
The animal is essentially moving around by dead reckoning, right? So won't the positional errors accumulate as it moves around?
In all animals that path integrate, the error for finding the home base again grows with the length of the excursion. So that's a general observation, and that's generally true. That's right. The question is, how well can they do?
I mean, I have an observation and a question. First, the observation. This seems like a general way to code any kind of space. So, for example, linguistic space, if I'm trying to figure out how to spell a word, I know that when I do this, I sort of focus in on the correct spelling in a gross way. And if you've been, and the linguistic data shows that that's how people read, you know, that they search the space. So I think that this is actually an interesting point. point that goes well beyond spatial encoding. But my question is, how, with this modular coding, how does it work for searching the space? It would seem as though it would be hard. If you drop the rat down in the middle of nowhere, how does it decide where it is?
All this is relative locations in this case.
Right.
So you would need some kind of visual landmark. I mean, there's no way it would know unless it has some external sensory input for where it is.
The rat is plopped down into the field, and it has to, it sees the things, and then it has to search its space in order to decide which way home.
If it has visual input, it knows where it is, because it sees the movie theater right in front of it, and it says, I'm near the movie theater, right? But if it has no movie theater, then maybe it doesn't care, absolutely. There's no such thing. It doesn't mean, it's not meaningful to have an absolute position label. It just cares to know whether it's come back to, you know, if it makes an excursion, it just wants to make sure it comes back to where it started out. In response to your first question, I'm not quite sure I see the analogy, because this is very precise. It relies on the fact that the encoded variable has a metric aspect to it. It's distance, and you're dropping it.
But any metric coding would work.
It's a code of an intrinsic, inherently metric variable. That's right. All right, thank you. I